Okay, so lecture 5 of the standard model and beyond. So today we're going to complete the standard model Lagrangian. So in some sense we'll have the full puzzle laid out on the table, and then we can begin to stare at it and see what we can make of it. Okay, but so let's start, as always, to get us back to where we were. We were in the middle of writing down the Lagrangian, and to continue doing so, we want our table here, my beloved table. If you were going to give me one table, if I had to choose just one table, this would surely be one of my top tables. At this table, I always wish that the board was a little bit higher. Anyway, okay, so we have Q left. U right, D right, and then the leptons, L left, nu right, which we will ignore for the moment, and E right. And okay, we have our fermions, and then we have our scalar field, the Higgs. Okay. You know and love this table by now. So let's, as a pedagogical point to make sure we know what's going on, let's just say one more thing about this table before we get back to writing down the Lagrangian. So let me just add another, extend the table a little bit to the left here.
Last time the U1 charge for the right-handed electron was negative.
Oh, thank you. It is. Sorry, that's a typo. Okay, so so let's just be clear what we're talking about here. So again, let's first look at the fermions here, the middle six rows. Or 5 if we ignore the right-handed neutrino. So, for example, this row. I've written this as a single fermion, but really it's a triplet under SU3, so it carries a three-dimensional internal index that the SU3 matrices act on. It's a singlet under SU2, so actually this is a triplet of objects. Okay, normally called the three colors of the right-handed up quark. So this is really U right red, U right green, and U right blue. Sort of conventional notation for those three basis vectors. And similarly, D right here is a triplet of objects. Both of these guys only carry an SU3 index, they don't carry an SU2 index. So here we have D right red, D right green, D right blue. Now Q left, well, it has three colors, but it also carries an SU2 index. It's a doublet of objects with respect to SU2. So let me make myself a little bit more space here. So this is a doublet of objects under SU2. So Q left is really two objects when we think of its SU2 index. And those objects are conventionally called U left and D left for reasons that we'll meet later on. But then in addition, it also carries an SU3 index. So each of those objects come in three colors. So really this is U left red, and D left red, and then U left green, and D left green, and U left blue, and D left blue. Okay, so those are the quarks, and then down here, new right, well, it doesn't have an SU2 index, it also doesn't carry any color, so new right is just a single spinner, and same with E right. But L left is a two-component object under SU2, so it's a doublet of two spinners, and these guys are conventionally called new left, the left-handed neutrino, and E left, the left-handed electron, in parallel with new right and E right here, for reasons that, again, we'll meet later on. So let's just pause for a moment to count the fermions, okay? So it looks here like we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 fermions, or 15, if we exclude the right-handed neutrino, which we will in the standard model. Now, in addition to that, there are three, again, each of these guys come in three families. So they carry an extra index I, which runs from 1 to 3, but has nothing to do with any of these gauge groups, or any gauge group, as far as we know at the moment. It's just some extra index. No one knows why it's there. But so each of these guys comes in three copies, so the number is really three times this. Okay, so that's the number of vial spinner fields, two-component spinner fields in the standard model. So we have 45 or 48, depending on whether we have the right-handed neutrino or not. Now we'll talk more about vial spinners when we're in a lecture to come shortly when we talk about neutrinos and try to get ourselves straight about that. But for now, so these are two-component spinner field. When we quantize, it will be, you know, a two-component spinner field like psi left will be the operator that annihilates one particle and creates one antiparticle. And then its dagger will be the operator that creates the corresponding particle or annihilates the corresponding antiparticle. So in other words, for each spinner field here, according to this counting, there are really two particles, one particle and one antiparticle. So if we also count, if we're counting particles here, and physically independent antiparticles, then we should multiply by 2. And so we have 90 particles in the standard model if we count particles and antiparticles separately, fermionic particles in the standard model, or 96 in the standard model where we extend by right-handed neutrinos. Okay? And then we still have to count bosons. It'll be better to do that later when we discuss spontaneous symmetry gradient. Okay, but so that's just to familiarize you a little bit more with the contents of the model, the meaning of this table. Okay, with that said, let's try to continue writing down the Lagrange. Okay, so where had we gotten yesterday? We're writing down the Lagrangian for the standard model. And again, our goal is to write down the most general expression. Oh, sorry, yeah?
Could you repeat why the last two came up? So we had 16.
This last two, yes. So the first two factors there, 15 times 3, there I was counting the number of two-component spinner fields in the standard model. So that's if I'm writing it down. If I just think about it as a classical Lagrangian, each of these guys that I've written here is really a two-component spinner field. It may be a right-handed two-component spinner field. Remember that when you have a Dirac, the Dirac, well, we'll talk about this more. I'll review this when we get to the neutrinos. In a forthcoming lecture, but the Dirac spinner in four dimensions, the spinner field that appears in the Dirac equation, has four components. But if you ask how do these guys transform under Lorentz transformations, they form a reducible representation. You can work in a basis where the top two guys mix with each other and the bottom two guys mix with each other. So these two irreducible representations, this one is called the left-handed spinner representation, and this one is called the right-handed spinner representation. And a key fact about the standard model that we'll be talking a lot more about later is that it breaks all the spinners. It's not elegantly stated in terms of Dirac spinners. If you want to state it at a fundamental level, you have to break the left and right-handed spinners into different parts, because the left-handed spinners transform one way under gauge transformations. For example, the left-handed spinners do transform as a doublet under SU2, whereas the right-handed part of the spinners don't. They don't transform under SU2. So that's what the first two factors are. The last factor is that let's say for example E right here. I erased the wrong two components. Let's say E right. Okay. So this is now a two-component spinner living above each point in space-time. But when we quantize, we promote this thing to an operator, which creates and annihilates particles. Well, how many particles does it create and annihilate? Well, it creates a particle, but it also annihilates an independent antiparticle. And we expand it in terms of, I'll review this, but when we in the canonical quantization approach, you'll Fourier expand this field, and the coefficients will become creation and annihilation operators, the Fourier coefficients. But there are two independent coefficients. There's an A coefficient, which is an annihilation operator of the particle here, the right-handed component of the electron. But there's also, in the same expansion, there will also be a coefficient B dagger, which is the operator which creates the corresponding antiparticle, the positron, which is the antiparticle of the right-handed electron. Those are two independent particles. You can produce one or the other in experiments. So you have to count them twice when you're counting the total number of particles in theory. So that's what that extra two is. Yeah?
Is that the copies of each fermion?
Mm-hmm.
How do we know it's different species if they have?
Same, if they have the same charges under the gauge force. Yes, that's a good question. And another thing that we'll be discussing in probably the next lecture, I'll be able to explain that better. But for now, let me just say that, now that you mention it, let me mention one other thing here. So let's say the three different copies that appear on this line. The fact that they have the same charges here means that they have exactly the same interactions with the gauge fields. So if the only things in life were the gauge interactions, then you would have, you wouldn't be able to distinguish between these three copies. They would be indistinguishable as far as you were concerned. But you would still be able to see that there were three different types instead of one. For example, if you were looking at how the universe expanded, it would be expanding three times faster than you thought if you only thought there was one copy of these things living in the early universe. I'll discuss this later. But for the time being, let me mention that the key point is that there is more to the standard model than just the gauge interactions. There's also the Higgs field. And the Higgs field, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, will end up giving masses to all these fermions. And it will give different masses to the different generations of fermions. And so they will have different mixing probabilities. So they will become perfectly physically distinguishable at the end of the day. And they have names. So the three copies here, the three different copies of you distinguish. For the standpoint of the table, the standpoint we're taking in this class is sort of trying to work in logical order. And so first write the standard model down as succinctly as possible, the bare minimum information I need to give you. Okay, it's this table. Then the next most expanded version will be to write the Lagrangian in its most elegant form. And for that purpose, it's useful to write these three copies as a single thing with an extra index. But then normally when you're doing physics at the LHC or something, you know, an LHC physicist won't refer to this all as the up and down quarks. They'll refer to the first generation, the first, when I equals one, they'll refer to those as up and down quarks. But when I equals two, the second generation, they'll refer to those as charm and strange quarks. And in the third generation, they'll refer to them as top and bottom quarks. And same thing for the so that same naming convention applies here. And then for the leptons, for the first generation, they'll call these the electron, the electron neutrino and the electron, and then the second generation will be the muon neutrino and the muon, and the third generation will be the tau neutrino and the tauon. But as I say, at the moment those are just names, but then we'll be discussing shortly how you actually how they end up being physically distinct like that. Okay, so, well, let's see. So then I won't. I was just going to write down the names for the different generations, but I guess I've done it. Well, let me do it. Okay, so again, UI, secretly the naming convention for that is that the three generations are called up, charm, and top. There's another name for those three. DI is a shorthand for D, down, strange, and bottom. Nu I is shorthand for electron neutrino, muon neutrino, and tau neutrino. And EI is shorthand for electron, muon, and tau. Tauon. Okay. Okay, so where were we here? Again, we were trying to write down, using these available fields, we were trying to write down the most general formula we could, which had four properties. It was Poincaré invariant, in other words, Lorentz invariant and translationally invariant, gauge invariant under those three gauge groups, under those three gauge symmetries, real, so every time we add any term, we have to make sure we also add its Hermitian conjugate, if its Hermitian conjugate was inequivalent. And finally, for starters, we're writing down just the renormalizable Lagrangians. We're only writing down the terms where the operator part has dimension 4 or less. Okay, and so how far had we gotten? Well, so far we'd written down the kinetic terms for all three of the different kinds of fields. So for the spin 1 fields, we had the Yang-Mills kinetic term. For the strong force, or for the SU3 gauge field. And so I remind you, this gauge field, even for fixed mu and nu, is a 3x3 matrix. And so we multiply those 3x3 matrices and then take the trace. And then there's the weak, corresponding weak kinetic, the kinetic term for the SU2 gauge field. And finally, the kinetic term for the U1 gauge field, so-called hypercharge gauge field. Then there was those are the spin 1 fields, their kinetic terms. Then there was the spin 0 field, the scalar field. Its kinetic term was d mu h dagger d mu h. So that's where capital D mu, we said, is the appropriate covariant derivative for acting on h. What do we mean by the appropriate covariant derivative? Well, it's this story that we talked about yesterday, where we have to look in the table at the row H, look at what representation H lives in, and that will tell us what representations of the three gauge fields to put into that connection. Okay, and then finally, we had the kinetic term for the spin 1/2 fields, and we said the most general thing we could write down there involved coupling each spin 1/2 field in that table to itself, basically. So we had kinetic terms that all looked, that all had basically the same form. Okay, so there's five or six terms here, depending on whether we include the right-handed neutrino. Okay, so that's where we were. Now, so fine. So we've written down the kinetic term. So what have we missed? What else is there? What other terms can we write down that satisfy the four conditions we wanted? Well, the first one are Yukawa couplings. The first and most let me say something else first. So we've focused so far on terms, on kinetic terms, by which field theorist just means any terms involving derivatives of the fields. Okay, all of these terms involve space-time derivatives acting on the fields. That's all I mean when I say they're kinetic terms. Let's try to think about now terms that don't involve any derivatives of the field. Well, the simplest sort of terms that we can write down that don't involve any derivatives of the field are just terms where it's just built from scalar fields by themselves. How can we make something, you know, if we build a term out of scalar fields, it's automatically going to be Lorentz invariant. You don't have to worry about that because scalar fields don't transform under Lorentz transformations. We just have to worry about gauge transformations. Well, we only have one scalar field to work with, and there's an obvious thing we can build out of it that is invariant, which is if we just write down H dagger H. Now, this guy has an upper SU2 index, which gets contracted with this guy's lower SU2 index. This guy has no SU3 index, and neither does this guy, so it's SU3 invariant, it's SU2 invariant, and it's also U1 invariant because this guy transforms with a charge plus 1/2 under U1, but this is the dagger, so it transforms with a phase minus 1/2. In other words, this guy transforms, if this guy picks up an e to the I times 1/2 alpha, this guy picks up an e to the I times minus 1/2 alpha because it's been conjugated. So this thing's invariant. So we can write down this term. And we have to put a coefficient in front. Now, this guy, by our counting the other day, has dimensions 1 plus 1. So the operator here is only dimension 2. So we're allowed to write that down because it's less than dimension 4. But now the whole Lagrangian still has to have dimension 4. So this has to have a coefficient in front which is dimensionful. So it has some dimensionful coefficient with dimensions of mass squared. So I call that m squared. And then the other thing we can write down is once we've built this invariant, the other thing we can write down which has dimension less than 4 is we just take this whole thing and square it. Okay. Okay, and those are the only two things we can write down that are purely built from scalars. And so this is the so-called, minus these two terms is the so-called potential for the Higgs field. So the potential for the, remember that when you have a scalar field, its Lagrangian looks like kinetic energy minus potential energy. So there's kinetic energy, which is this guy, and then there's minus its potential energy. So since the potential energy comes with a minus sign, it's saying that the Higgs potential here is B Higgs is equal to, I have to put minus signs in front of both these guys, so it's equal to minus m squared h dagger h, and then plus lambda over 4 h dagger h squared. And I've chosen these signs just for convention, so that for convenience later, so that if I chose m squared to be positive and I chose lambda to be positive, which will be the case I do want physically, then this potential will look like close to the origin. It'll be a negative parabola, a downgoing parabola, and then further from the origin, lambda will cause it to lift up. And so the lowest energy points on this potential will be away from the origin here. And so that will be responsible for a so-called spontaneous symmetry breaking in the standard model. Okay? So there you go. So now lines 1, 2, and 3 are done. So we are still trying to think about what other terms we can write down that don't involve derivatives. So the other type of term that you probably met in your quantum field theory course is that you can write down a Yukawa term. So in other words, normally you write down to make a term with two spinners and something else that is Lorentz invariant. Well, we've already seen that the kinetic term does the trick. So if we write down two spinner fields and put a derivative in between, a Dirac operator in between, that's a Lorentz invariant object. Also, you may know from your QFT class that you could just put down two fields like this, two spinners by themselves, contract them like this. That would be Lorentz invariant. So we might ask, well, could we do that in the standard model? That would have only dimension 3/2 plus 3/2 equals 3. In principle, we might be allowed to do something like that. Can we write down any term like that that is gauge invariant? And the answer turns out to be no. Okay, so why does the answer turn out to be no? You can't write down any term like this. This would be a mass term, by the way. If you write, this is exactly what the mass term looks like in a normal spinner Lagrangian. Looks like minus coefficient m times psi bar psi. So any term like this, coupling two of these guys directly, that would be a mass term. Why can't we write it down? Well, the reason is that suppose you take any field here. Okay, let's try D right. Okay, now we want to write down the bar of some spinner to make a gauge invariant object here. Well, this guy has an SU3 index, so we better write down the bar of something that also has an SU3 index. So we have to choose one of the quark fields to put here. So what could we try? It also has no SU2 index, so we don't want to write down something with an SU2 index, because then we would have a hanging SU2 index here. It wouldn't be SU2 invariant. So we have to rule out Q left bar. We can't put that. So our only options here are to put U right or D right. Now U right, if we wrote down U right bar here, that would be SU3 invariant, it would be SU2 invariant, but it wouldn't be U1 invariant because this guy would transform with a charge with charge minus 1/3. This guy would transform with U right has charge plus 2/3. When we dagger, we take the minus of that. So this would be minus 1/3, this would be minus 2/3. This whole thing would transform with charge minus 1, so it wouldn't be invariant. So it looks like the only thing we could write down that would be gauge invariant would be D right contracted with D right bar. But then, and that would be gauge invariant, but we run into another problem, which is that it would be zero. Because the reason it's zero is because, remember D right bar is D right dagger. Okay, so D right is some four-component spinner whose first two components are zero and second two components are non-zero. Okay, I'm trying to draw them just as dots. Sorry, it's a little bit of a confusing notation. So D right looks like that. And then D right dagger, well, the dagger of this guy is some row vector where now these two components are zero and these two components, my dots, are both complex conjugated. But then this is not just D right dagger, it's D right dagger times gamma zero. And in the basis where the right-handed guys and left-handed guys are up and down here, and in any basis where the left-handed guys and right-handed guys have been split explicitly into the top two and bottom two basis components, the matrix gamma zero is off diagonal. Okay, so it looks just like the matrix gamma zero, I guess, is just 1, 1 in this basis. This is a 2x2 matrix, and this is a 2x2 matrix, and this is a 0 and 0 are 2x2 matrices. And so if you just evaluate this this thing, you know, so when we multiply this matrix here, we get an object whose top two, we'll get a vector whose, yeah, if you, you see what I mean. If you multiply this vector times this guy, we'll get a new vector, this thing will evaluate to a vector whose top two components are non-zero and whose bottom two components are zero. So then when we multiply it by this row vector, the non-zero components here hit the zero components here, and the whole thing vanishes. Okay, so that's an important thing about the standard model, is that it is impossible, gauge invariance and Lorentz invariance, combined with that table, rule out the possibility of writing down any explicit mass terms here. So if we're going to get, okay, so we can't write them down. If we're going to get masses, we have to get them some other way. Well, there's another type of term we can write down. This was a dimension 3 term, so we still have room to add another operator of dimension 1 and still have the operator be less than dimension 4. Previously, the operator of dimension 1 we added was the derivative operator. But the other thing we can add is a scalar field, phi. Okay, that sort of term that couples two fermions and a scalar is called a Yukawa term. So let's see what are the Yukawa terms we can write down in the standard model. Okay, let's try as our first example, let's try to write down a Yukawa term where this spinner is Dirac. So what are our options? Well, we want to then add a scalar field. We only have one scalar field to work with, so we write down H. And now we need to write down one more spinner field to make this thing gauge invariant. If we write down some spinner field bar, it'll be Lorentz invariant, but we need to also make it gauge invariant. Now, we could go through this argument I just gave about listing all the different possible fermions and seeing if they could soak up all the indices here. But we can make our lives easier by remembering what we just saw, which is that when we couple two fermions in a mass term, if we have a right-handed guy here, this guy has to be a left-handed guy in order to get a non-zero answer. We just saw that if this was any right-handed fermion, two right-handed fermions coupled like that give zero. So this has to be something left. Adding a scalar field doesn't change anything about that. That was all about the algebra of the spinner indices, and the scalar field goes right through that. So that's still true. We're going to have to write down some left-handed spinner here. So this guy has an SU3 index, and this guy doesn't. So we have a hanging SU3 index we need to soak up. So this has to be between our two options, Q left and L left. We had better use Q left here to soak up the SU3 index. Okay, so let's try this thing. So This SU3 index is contracted with this lower one, so that thing is SU3 invariant. What about SU2? Well, this guy carries no SU2 index, but this guy does carry an upper SU2 index. This guy carries a lower SU2 index, because it's also, these guys are both doublets, but we've taken the dagger of this guy. So this is also SU2 invariant if we contract those two indices. So far, so good. What about U1? This guy has charge minus a third. This guy has charge plus a half, and this guy had charge plus 1/6 before we daggered it, so now it has charge minus 1/6. And indeed, if you look, minus 1/6 plus a half minus a third, that is indeed zero. So great, we have found our first Yukawa coupling that is invariant under all three gauge groups, and also Lorentz invariant, and also non-zero. Okay, so let's go write that down. So the first term we get to write down as a Yukawa coupling is Q left bar times the Higgs doublet times D right. Okay, now remember we had this story in this term that, you know, remember secretly, each of these guys carries a family index, a generation index, I. And remember there was this story yesterday that in principle, we could have written down a general. At the end of, in principle, we could have written down a general combination Qi and Qj from two different families. Let's say Q1 and Q1 from the first family and Q2 from the second family. And we could have, all those terms would be Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant, and we would have to write down a matrix of coefficients, Kij, a 3x3 matrix. But what then we remembered, oh, we have to not only add this term, but its Hermitian conjugate. Well, its Hermitian conjugate looks just like this. If you work out what the Hermitian conjugate of this is, it's just this, but you've complex conjugated this matrix. So you taken its dagger, so, and taken its transpose, because you bring, when you take the Hermitian conjugate, you bring this guy over here and turn it into a bar. You bring this guy over there and turn it, take the bar away. So we end up having two terms, one involving K, the other involving K dagger. We just add them together, and the resulting matrix is K plus K dagger. So in other words, it's Hermitian. So instead, we can simplify our lives by just taking K to be Hermitian right from the start. But then we said, oh, any Hermitian matrix can be diagonalized into U lambda U inverse. We absorb the U's into the Q's by a field redefinition. And then we also said we could split the lambda into lambda to the 1/2, lambda to the 1/2, these two diagonal matrices, and absorb those real diagonal matrices also. So at the end of the day, we could completely absorb this matrix so that all we have here is an identity matrix, delta ij. So that at the end of the day, Qi only ends up getting coupled to Qi, and Ui only gets coupled to Ui. And so we just are summing over these diagonal combinations, Q1, U1, plus Q2, Q2, plus Q3, Q3. OK. I mention that because here, it's important that there is a less trivial story. So now, again, we have the same sort of thing happening. But we have to make sure that anything we do to try to absorb the extra matrix that appears here doesn't mess up what we already did. We already decided to choose our conventions so that the fields were defined so that the matrix here was the identity matrix. So we have to maintain that here. So what happens? So I just argued that a term like this was Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant. But again, as before, I can insert, give myself a little more space here. As before, I can insert, in fact, let me not write this here. So I have my term here, minus Q left I bar times H times D right J. And now again, for any combination of I and J, this is perfectly fine, and I can put some arbitrary complex coefficient in front of it. So let me write the coefficient in front of the ij combination as, I'll call that yij and y sub d. Okay, I'll call that matrix y sub d. So before I tell you how much we can simplify this, because that will be an important thing in understanding, it's kind of a technical point, but important for understanding what are the actual physical particles in the standard model, and how do they behave, let's write down the other Yukawa coupling terms that we can write down. So I went through this argument with D. Wright about how it turns out that Q left is the only option that you can write down that works. So a very good exercise, very important exercise that I won't do on the board in full, but which is definitely worth going through on your own, and maybe we will even do it in the tutorial to some extent, is making sure that the only Yukawa terms that you can write down in an analogy with this one are the following. There's only two more you can write down, okay? You could also write down a guy that has U-right. Okay, sorry. Let me give you the U-right case because there's something I need to explain. Let's try writing down one more term. Same exercise, but involving U-right. So now let's say we wrote down U-right And again, we introduced the scalar field H. And now we're trying to figure out what fermion bar we can write down to make something gauge invariant. Well, by the same argument as before, this has a hanging SU3 index, which this guy does not. So there's an SU3 index we still need to soak up. So we'd better write down a quark field here. Since this is a right-handed spinner, it has to be a left-handed guy. So Q left is really the only option that would work. Let's try writing that down and see what happens. Well, it's SU3 invariant because of the contraction of this index and that index. It's SU2 invariant because of the contraction of that index and that index. But what about U1? Now we run into trouble, okay? This guy has charge 2/3. This guy has charge 1/2. This guy has charge plus 6 with a minus sign, so minus 1/6. So this does not add up anymore to 0. So this term would not be U1 invariant. So what do we do? Can we just not write down a Yukawa term involving the up quark? Well, it turns out that would be a disaster. So there's something which comes to the rescue, a little an important special fact about group theory, which is that so H transforms as a doublet. We said that, so this guy transforms like H goes to U2H, where U2 is this 2x2 unitary matrix. Now, H star seems to transform it. So this representation is what is usually known as the 2. If we take the complex conjugate of H, it looks like it transforms in a different two-dimensional representation of H, which would normally be called the 2 bar. Okay, so in the case of SU3, for example, when we have a quark, and it transforms as a triplet under SU3, so it transforms to U3Q under a gauge transformation. If we consider the corresponding complex conjugated field, that transforms like, okay, strictly speaking, this would be the charge conjugated field, but anyway, let's leave that for the neutrino day. The point is the corresponding complex conjugated field transforms like U3 star. So this representation is a three-dimensional representation that you would call the 3. This one is a different, inequivalent three-dimensional representation, and its difference is denoted by calling it by a different name, 3 bar. Okay, they're both three-dimensional representations, but they're not equivalent to each other. They're two different irreducible representations. For SU2, it naively looks like H star transforms under a different representation, 2 bar. But an important detail about group theory is that the 2 bar and 2 representations are actually equivalent. So there is a change of basis that we can do in this space so that actually this thing transforms just like this one does. So in particular, what we do is we introduce the change of basis is that you conjugate. If we do a change of basis by the change of basis matrix is exactly I times the second Pauli matrix. In other words, if we define H twiddle to be I sigma 2 times H star, okay, we've just taken H star and performed this little change of basis here, then it turns out this guy exactly transforms like U2 H twiddle. So it exactly transforms in the 2, in the representation 2 again. It transforms under SU2, it transforms exactly the same way that H does. But because we've taken the star, it has the opposite U1 charge. Under the U1 phase, it's the opposite. So in fact, let's add. It's like we can add. So H twiddle is not an independent field, but it's conventional to define it because it's just as a useful notation. And it's as if we have another line in our table here. I didn't leave myself enough room, unfortunately, to write this line very clearly. But it's as if we have another line. Okay, that says H twiddle. I apologize, that's so small. Where again, it's a singlet under SU3. Again, it's a doublet under SU2. But now it has charge minus a half under U1. Okay, everything's the same, but its U1 charge has been flipped. Okay, well, that's good news. Because now that means if we put H twiddle here, oh, sorry, wrong term. If we put H twiddle here instead, now, just as before, this thing is SU3 invariant because these two indices are contracted. It's SU2 invariant because these two indices are contracted. But now, the charge here is minus a half. This thing does vanish. So now it's also U1 invariant. So, okay, so this is the second Yukawa term we can write down. I'll just make room to write. And again, we have to include a matrix that connects. The different generations. Okay, so these are all the quark Yukawa terms we can write down. It turns out that a very good exercise to go through is that these are the only combinations of fields you can write down built from the quarks that are invariant. And then with the leptons, there's only one more term you can write down in the standard model. So in the standard model, you could write down the analogous term, which looks like which couples the left-handed lepton doublet bar to the right-handed electron. And in this case, I'll call the 3x3 matrix that appears YE. Okay, so I'm always naming the matrix by giving it a subscript which matches the corresponding right-handed fermion that appears, as is conventional. And then if we had the extra right-handed neutrino in the game, which again, for the standard model, we don't. But if and when we do, there will be one other Yukawa coupling we can write down, which couples the left-handed lepton doublet to, again, through H twiddle, to the new right. Okay. So now that is sometimes how you will see the fourth line on the this is sometimes how the fourth line in that expression would be written. But I just want to go one step further before writing the fourth line over there in final form. And so why is that? Well, maybe before I go a step further, it's time to pause. Has anyone written? Yes, question?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm not sure if you have the argument. We have these matrices Y taken into account.
Which again, I don't know if I said this clearly, but again, those are not fields. They're just matrices. They're just arbitrary 3x3 constant complex matrices.
But that doesn't make our term permission, right?
Very good point. Thank you for saying that. Yes. So unlike the previous three lines, where when we add the Hermitian conjugate here, we'll find we don't get any new terms. Here, you're absolutely right. That what we have is this plus its Hermitian conjugate. Very good point. And so, for example, the Hermitian conjugate of this term. Let's just write the first term as an example. The first term, the Hermitian conjugate of it, would look like d right bar. Okay, so from now on, I'm going to switch notation, which is just like for the rest of the indices. There's all sorts of indices running around here. Spinner indices here and here, SU3 indices here and here, SU2 indices here and here. Mostly we're not writing them out explicitly, we're just using the normal sort of vector and matrix notation where matrix multiplication is implied whenever two things have share indices that are contracted. So far I've been writing the family indices explicitly, but let's revert to the normal notation, matrix notation. So I'll erase these indices. And so now this just means that this guy is a three-component column, three-component row vector, which is getting multiplied from the left on this 3x3 matrix, which is then hitting this three-component column vector. Okay. Let's erase everywhere. And then that'll make it easier to write the corresponding Hermitian conjugate expression. So the Hermitian conjugate I'll just write for this term would be d right r h dagger, this 3x3 matrix dagger, and then q left. Okay, and there's a corresponding term for each of these guys. And in practice, I will just always be writing plus Hermitian conjugate, but unless I forget to do that. But I, so yes, good point. Anybody have a limerick? Yeah, oh, you're of your own composition? Oh, my man, go for it. Do you need yeah, you go.
Yeah, so I took up Latham's challenge and wrote this limerick. I have to admit, it's sort of a ripoff, the one from yesterday, at least in terms of the theme. But okay, so it goes, Einstein was up in a tree. He was looking as smug as can be. When someone asked why, he said, I'm up high, so time passes faster for me.
My friends, I think you all know what you have witnessed here. The gauntlet has been thrown down. I expect an answer. Okay, so let's continue. That was great, of course. It need hardly be said that that was the greatest limerick I've ever heard. Okay, so we're almost there. Why aren't we done? So the problem is, at the moment, I've written down three arbitrary, okay, let's forget this guy. At the moment, I've written down three arbitrary 3x3 complex matrices, but now most of the parameters in those matrices are unphysical and can again be reabsorbed by field redefinitions, just like we did with the kinetic term for the fermions when we turned all those arbitrary matrices into identity matrices. Okay, but it's important to get this one right because it has physical implications, and Nobel Prizes were awarded for various aspects of these implications. So so basically, for starters, now YD, YU, and YE are not Hermitian matrices. So we don't have the normal, for a Hermitian matrix, K, we can diagonalize that as a unitary matrix times a real diagonal matrix times U inverse. But for a general arbitrary matrix, we can't do that. But for a general arbitrary 3x3 matrix, we do have the so-called singular value decomposition, which is the closest analog, which says that we can diagonalize it in the following way. Diagonalize is maybe not the right term, but we can take any arbitrary matrix, and there is a decomposition where we split it into a real diagonal matrix, which I'll call little y, so little y sub d, for, and then times two different unitary matrices. So now we have V dagger and U dagger appearing here. So it's not just a change of basis, it's something fancier. Okay, but that's called the singular value decomposition. So let's do that for each of these three matrices. So here we have VU dagger times little YU times U sub U. And here we have V sub E dagger, little Y sub E, capital U sub E. Okay, and now, to what extent can we absorb these various V's and U's into field redefinitions? Well, let's try and see what happens. So So every time we have this, every time we have our y here, we can imagine splitting it into a little y and a v dagger and a u. Well, the u's so we have these three different u's can be absorbed into the three different right-handed fields here, okay, that they're adjacent to. So in other words, we'll define d right prime is equal to u sub d times the old d right, and we'll define the new field u right prime to be u sub u times the old u right, and we'll define e right prime to be u sub e times the old e right. Okay, so we've absorbed each of the u's into the neighboring field. What about the v's? Well, we again have three v's occurring on the left here, here, and here, but we have only two fields to absorb them into. Okay, so here we can define q left prime is equal to v sub u times q left, and l left prime is equal to v sub e times l left. So that will absorb the v here into this field, and the v here into this field. But then what do we do about this last guy? And I wish I had left myself more room here. Will it screw up anyone's copying down if I erase this line? I desperately want to erase it. So, and this one. Sorry. So, okay, maybe what I'll do is move these guys down. Okay, so far we've managed to rewrite this guy as minus L left bar prime, because we absorbed using this field redefinition, the V, and then we have left over the little y that was in the middle, and then we absorbed the capital U into this guy, so we have H times E right prime. Okay, so now this matrix is just a real diagonal matrix. Same thing here. We've managed to rewrite this guy as q left prime times little y sub u times h twiddle times u right prime. But now over here, what happens? Well, to rewrite this as q left prime, you see, this guy, if you think about it, it's a little y, and then there's a u sub d, there's a v sub d dagger here, which we haven't yet absorbed. And then we want to insert, to turn this into a q prime along with everybody else, we want to insert the identity in the form v sub u dagger. Okay, if we insert v sub u dagger in here, v sub u dagger, v sub u, we can absorb the v sub u dagger into q left and turn it into q left prime just like we did before. So in other words, we can write this guy as q left prime y sub d h d right prime. But here, there's some extra bit which we haven't managed to absorb. If you go through the algebra, there's the, from this singular value decomposition, there's the v sub d dagger matrix still sitting around here, unabsorbed. And then we had inserted this unity here, absorbed this part, but this part is still unabsorbed. So there's this matrix here, v sub u times v sub d dagger, which we haven't managed to absorb. And that unabsorbable 3x3 unitary matrix is called the CKM matrix, for Kabibo, Kobayashi, Moskawa. These guys, Kobayashi and Moskawa, got the Nobel Prize a few years ago for realizing that this thing had to be there and its implications. Okay, so far it looks like, so we're still almost there. we have these three terms. In these first two terms, we just have a 3x3 real diagonal matrix. In this guy, we have a real diagonal matrix times the CKM matrix. Okay, and in fact, let me just stick this guy in here. Okay, now finally, before we're ready to write it over there, I just want to make one other point, which is that, so far it looks like V is a general unitary matrix, and a general unitary matrix has 9 independent real degrees of freedom, because remember, you can write a general unitary matrix as e to the I times a Hermitian matrix, and a Hermitian 3x3 matrix, well, it has 3 real diagonal components, and then 3 complex off-diagonal components, and then these guys are not independent. These guys have to be the lower diagonal has to be the complex conjugate of the upper diagonal. So we have 1, 2, 3 plus 6 real numbers. So it looks naively like there's 9 real parameters in here, but you can absorb 5 more of them. Why is that? You can absorb 5 of those 5 complex phases because you can take each. So suppose we absorb into each Q left and U right, we absorb a phase e to the I beta. So we absorb the same phase into both of those guys. Okay, into the ith Q left, we absorb the phase beta I, e to the I beta I. And into the ith U right, we absorb the same phase e to the I beta I. Well, then that will leave this term invariant because this is a diagonal matrix. We have a diagonal matrix of phases that we're absorbing over here and over here, but they're conjugates of one another, and all 3 of these matrices commute, and so those 2 conjugate matrices hit each other and do nothing. If you think about absorbing these 3 phases into redefinitions here, you'll see that you've done nothing to this matrix in between. You haven't absorbed anything else from it. But here, where we don't have a diagonal matrix, now, when we absorb these phases into Q left, it does change this guy. And into D right, we can also absorb 3 different phases. So let's call them alpha I. So it looks like we have the freedom to soak up 3 plus 6 more real numbers. When we make these, in other words, we have 6 real numbers here, the 3 alpha I's and the 3 beta I's, which we can absorb into field redefinitions, which don't do anything to this guy, but which do change this matrix over here. So they change this matrix over here. So it looks like we've managed to soak up 6 more real numbers out of this guy. But actually, as you can check, if all the beta I's and all the alpha I's are equal, so if those 6 real numbers are all equal to one another, then that redefinition will do nothing to VCKM. So actually, you're only soak up 5 real numbers that way. So at the end of the day, because I'm out of time, I'm not going to rewrite it over there. But so at the end of the day, the standard model Lagrangian, okay, I will, sorry. It's important to have it all in one place here. I'm doing everything in a rush, sorry. Okay, so here we have what is normally taken to be the standard model Lagrangian. There is one more term. There is one more line, which we didn't have a chance to write down and explain why you don't normally have to think about it. But I'll do that at the beginning of the next lecture. But there's three other terms we could write down that are topological terms involving the gauge field, where we write down G and G, but instead of contracting the indices using the metric, we contract them using the epsilon tensor. We can do the same thing here and same thing here. And then it turns out that these two guys are unobservable. This guy, the topological term corresponding to this guy, in principle should be observable, but in practice we haven't seen its observational effects. So that's a famous problem called the strong CP problem. It appears that the coefficient of the corresponding topological term here is very small or zero for reasons which we're not sure what they are yet, but that's the strong CP problem. But so modulo those topological terms, which usually you ignore, this is the Lagrangian for the standard model. I guess we will celebrate it just by really ending the class and having lunch. But I didn't get to quite have the celebration that I anticipated about it. But there you go. That's the Lagrangian. We'll begin to unpack it next time. Yeah.
I don't understand why the QL and the kinetic term would be the same as the QL in the coupling terms, because we change the spaces also.
Thank you for that point. Yes. Okay. So what happened here was that I absorbed the QLs into I absorbed the U's and V's as much as I could into redefinitions of the field, which I renamed Q prime. And as you rightly say, what happened over here? Well, because that redefinition doesn't change, if you think about it, it won't change any of these terms, except what it will do is change them to primes. Because let's say in this term, for example, I had redefined QL, I redefined QL as QL prime is equal to VU QL. Okay, so I could do the same thing in this term by inserting VU dagger VU. I could insert unity in the form VU dagger VU. And then this would become, I could absorb this VU dagger over here and turn this into QL prime. I could absorb this VU over here and turn this into QL prime. So now everybody on this line has just changed by turning into a primed object. And similarly, if I had kept the notation over there, everybody on this line has a prime. And now I'm just going to drop all the primes. Okay, so thank you. I didn't explain that clearly. But so the point is that, I guess I just said it. So at the end of the day, after all the redefining, the point of absorbing unitaries here was that by absorbing unitaries, I didn't change the form of any of these terms. So, and at the end of the day, I just drop the primes. You won't see the primes anymore.